United States v. Stark.
May it please the Court, my name is Jeff Eberhard, and I represent the appellant Danny Stark Sr. This appeal centers around the denial of Mr. Stark's right to testify. Mr. Stark always wanted to testify in his defense, but was not afforded that opportunity. Then, having been denied the opportunity to testify, Mr. Stark was subjected to criticism from both the prosecutor and his own lawyer for not testifying, which was the very thing he wanted to do.
But how did he signal to the district court judge that he wanted to testify? There are some conversations that he has with the judge, but actually they don't sound at all to me as though he's saying, I want to testify. He's talking about subpoenaing additional witnesses. He certainly doesn't need to subpoena himself if what he wants to do. And actually, at one point in the pretrial hearing, the judge mentions that he has a right to testify and says to the defense lawyer, you know, let me know later whether he's going to do this. I mean, I just don't see anywhere where he in any way gives the judge a clue, you know, that this is on his mind somehow.
I understand. And I can see that he didn't use the magic words. And I think the reason for that is simple, is he simply didn't know he had that right. He can't have raised a concern that he didn't know existed.
This wasn't his first turn at bat, you know. He had been around the horn about 14 times, if I recall.
And he had only been to trial once, and that case was 25 years ago.
And he never... He was unaware of the fact, having hung around all these times, that the defendants do testify regularly. And
well, there was a unique circumstances in this case, in that the reason he believed he didn't have the right to testify was because he signed a proffer letter, which he had never done before. He had never encountered that scenario before. And he had conversations with his first lawyer in which he gained the understanding, which is obviously mistaken, but that was his understanding, that because he signed that proffer letter...
Someplace along the line, he has to let somebody know that he wants to shoot off his mouth. And I did just what Judge Wood did, went through the whole record for it. I couldn't figure out any place he said that he wanted to.
No, he didn't. But here's what he did say.
He didn't even give you a long hint. Go ahead.
No, I don't believe the Seventh Circuit requires him to abuse the magic words.
Somehow they have to give an indication he thinks he doesn't know he has a right to, or he wants to testify. If he had a right to testify, he would.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think what he did tell the court was that he was unhappy with the course of his defense, that his counsel's decisions were overriding his own desires. He told the judge, I spent 2 years trying to get my story out. You wait 2 years, you want to get the true story out. You want all of it out, not just bits and pieces.
That was very close. The judge isn't going to say, well, what were your conversations with your lawyer? I mean, there's an attorney-client privilege, after all, that the judge is going to...
Yes. The decisions of this court in which they state that the district court does not have a duty in all cases to raise the defendant's right to testify, the concern there is they don't want to interfere with the attorney-client relationship.
Right.
Here, the lawyer has stood up and said, Your Honor, we're at an impasse. That relationship was destroyed. That the court knew that they weren't communicating effectively, they were at an impasse, that counsel's decisions were overriding Mr. Stark's, that they were having serious disagreements about the course of the defense. I would submit to you that this...
But that's the problem. Right there was an opportunity for the defendant to say, and one of the things we're disagreeing about is my ability to take the stand.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that would have been a way for the court to know. Or if counsel had said, without giving up anything that was privileged... You know, we're on this issue of the right to testify, or, you know, we're having a dispute of anything, but the court didn't know, and consistent with the case law, I mean, that's problematic for you. And to say, you know, I want my whole case presented, mm-hmm. is a different thing than saying, and I want to present it.
He was there, wasn't he, when the judge said, will it be tendered claim to testify?
We're going to put it
on the record. I do recall that statement at the pretrial conference, and I wasn't there. I don't know if he was present.
Yeah, but I mean, the record shows he was there. I mean, because he has to be there at all stages of the proceeding, or else you got a different mm-hmm. beef altogether. They're sneaking off someplace and running through us without talking to him. But he was there, heard him talk about whether he was going to testify. So it wasn't something that he didn't realize was available to him.
Well, I think he testified
Listen,
fully.
You're doing a good job with what you had. I'm not fighting with you.
Yeah, I mean, whether he, even if he was there and the court made that comment, Mr. Stark testified fully at the hearing for the motion for new trial that he didn't understand he had that right. Yeah, and I don't know that we
and
can...
And the judge didn't believe him, but go ahead.
And the judge didn't believe him, but that was in a completely different context, first of all. And second of all, Mr. Stark's daughter testified at that same hearing, corroborated Mr. Stark's story, said that the lawyer told her that Mr. Stark was legally prohibited from testifying. Mm. So this isn't just some situation where, you know, he submits a self-serving affidavit.
Daughters are lovely things. I have a couple of them myself.
And again, I think we have a very unique situation here where had he known that he had the right to testify, he could have raised it, but here he didn't. And I think there is substantial evidence that he didn't know that he had the right.
It would have been a catastrophe, actually, though. I mean, there's the proffer in which I believe he admits that he was involved in the theft of these tractors, and it certainly would have opened the door to that getting in, and all this business about his son and everything. It's hard for me to see, going on to your final point about ineffectiveness of counsel, how this wasn't a perfectly rational bit of advice, at least, for the lawyer to give, not to force, but had the lawyer said, I'm advising you in my professional judgment that you'd be better off not testifying, surely that's within the realm, don't you think?
Yeah, that might be, but with respect to the waiver, counsel can't waive the right to testify on behalf of Mr. Stark.
That's why I'm phrasing
it the way I am. To suggest you'd be a damn fool if you do is a perfectly legitimate thing to do.
Yeah, that's, and I think my ineffective assistance of counsel argument is more aimed at what happened at trial. He didn't take any steps to ensure...
At the closing argument, principally?
Right, he didn't object to the prosecutor's closing argument. He made his own improper comment. And even taking a step back, even under his version of the story, he spoke with Mr. Stark about testifying some months before trial, never returned to the issue. This is a four-week trial in which things kind of blew up in the middle of the defense's case, and he took no steps to go back to Mr. Stark and have a further conversation about his right to testify. Mr. Baralski, Mr. Stark's trial lawyer, even testified at the hearing on the motion for new trial that the judge pulled him aside during the government's case and asked him whether Mr. Stark would testify outside of Mr. Stark's presence. And he didn't even go back and ask Mr. Stark. He said no. The answer is no, Your Honor. And I think all that taken together, I don't think Mr. Stark received adequate representation. And again, like I said, whether it was a good idea that Mr. Stark testify or not, the Constitution affords him an absolute right, even if it's the worst decision in the world, and he wasn't afforded that opportunity here. I'd like to let's talk about the closing argument. You know, I think there's a painful irony here. Mr. Stark wanted to testify, was not afforded that opportunity, and then was subjected to criticism for not taking the stand. And here, what the
government... Could one read it that way, or could one read what the prosecutor's saying? I mean, a whole story by this time has been presented on behalf of Mr. Stark through a lot of witnesses. You know, that this was really all this deceased son's, you know, bad action and all the rest. So that's been presented to the jury, and the prosecutor certainly can comment on Mr. Stark's version of the case presented through the, you know, witnesses that were there.
That's an interesting theory if it fit the facts, but that wasn't Mr. Stark's story. Mr. Stark's principal witness, his girlfriend, Miss Skiles, testified that it was Mr. Morey who was behind all this, that he came in and said... They knew he had another job in which he delivered tractors to John Deere dealers, and that he was the one that was the ringleader behind this. So it might be a different case if that was the defense's theory, that it was Danny Stark Jr. who had done this, but that wasn't what they were arguing. And in fact, it was the government's own witnesses who were pointing the finger at Jr.
Okay, you're about to run out of time, so if you want to save...
I'll save the rest of my time.
I'll give you a little bit of rebuttal.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. Yes, Mr. Quinley.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Michael Quinley. I'm representing the government. I was co-counsel at the trial below. Yes, Mr. Stark was present during proceedings, and in fact, as the judge pointed out on the record in one of the sessions, that even when there were sidebars, Mr. Stark, although shackled, had a listening device at table. I mean, he made some comment as I was just reviewing
this. So I take it the sidebar was when the judge asked, is the defendant going to take the stand? And
well, that's correct, Your Honor, although you mentioned about some other complaint. I think I missed it, but Mr. Borelski commented upon it to the court that the court had, in fact, inquired of him.
So did he hear that? Did Stark hear it? That's the question.
I can't say that. He certainly did hear. I think the first question was to the pretrial.
Well,
right.
What was the sidebar? If you said he had.
Well, I missed it, Your Honor. So
you didn't hear that.
No. Apparently that was between Mr. Borelski and the judge. But as you note, I was excluded and my co-counsel from the courtroom on two separate occasions.
Were the defendants' ear things still available to them for the sidebars during the thing?
Oh, yes. All through the trial. Okay. Absolutely, Your Honor. And that was the other conversation. I know it's not the context, but I included these because they were sealed for me, and so I have particular interest in them. But I think they are very revealing. The letter's not here, but at the end of the first session, as the court goes about his concern about the length of trial and cumulative evidence, he does say, and again, I don't want to put too much weight on this, he says, okay, talk to Ms. Borelski about that tonight and prioritize what you want. If we have to, we'll go into your testimony on Wednesday and we'll hold the jury over until Thursday. Now, the context is such that when the court's referring to your testimony, he's talking about the witnesses that Mr. Starks wants to put on. I mean, but clearly, as the courts have already mentioned,
he's addressing the defendant at this stage of the game.
Oh, yes, he's speaking. Oh, Mr. Stark and the court are, you see, Mr. Stark didn't just communicate through his lawyer. He communicated directly with the court. He communicated with a letter. The court excluded the government from the courtroom and twice had private sessions. Well, Mr. Borelski was there where he engaged directly with Mr. Stark about how to best make sure Mr. Stark had a fair trial. And Mr. Stark responds, I appreciate your help. I was just letting you know that. It wasn't so much about Ted, that's his counsel, or his duties, but I can see that he is overwhelmed. Court, this is a big case, a lot of documents. Mr. Stark, it is a pile of stuff to go through. I can't keep up myself, and I haven't been. And then the court says, right, I understand. I have to tell you, he is a bulldog. I don't usually get attorneys that push back, frankly, and he has pushed back. So you haven't gotten an attorney that is laying down and playing dead. Mr. Stark, no, sir. It's no wonder the court made the credibility finding it did sentencing hearing, or the hearing before the sentencing, where the motion for new trial with new appointed counsel that was fully briefed and evidence presented. I'd like to just turn, if I may, quickly.
Let me just ask you one question. Is it the practice in the Southern District, and I realize the Constitution doesn't require it, but is it the practice that the district court says when you're in the defense case, in the presence of the defendant and with defense counsel and the government present, you know, does the defendant intend to testify and get the lawyer on the record to say yes or no? I mean, clearly, if that had been done, we wouldn't be here today, probably.
Well, that would have just been the lawyer again.
I understand, right. But it would have been in the presence of the client before the court.
You don't
have
to deal with that. It picks it up from a mile and a half away. You don't have to get closer to the microphone than you are.
You can let it sag
down there and go right on with your talking. The mic will pick up all the thing. You don't have to play with it.
Thank you, Your Honor. Yeah. Thank you for raising that, because I did want to mention this, and I had almost neglected to. I think this court, unlike some other circuits around the country, has counseled, you know, courts ought to be careful about interfering with the attorney-client relationship. This may have been an easy call in this case, but normally it's a difficult decision. Do you put the client on? Do you not put the client on? And for the court to interfere and muck around in that and perhaps influence the client to do what's not in his best counsel's interest.
Well, clearly, that's our law.
Well,
and
guess
I'm not
what?
Saying. I'm not
Nobody's,
saying.
Nobody's. Nobody. Many district courts aren't following that advice anymore. I was in trial last week. Judge Gilbert, he has a colloquy. Nobody requested the colloquy. He does it in every case.
Well, and that's why I was asking
the defendant.
That's why I was asking the question what the practice was in the Southern District.
And well, it
doesn't,
varies.
Let me just finish.
Yeah, excuse me.
And it doesn't mean that the court has to go into why did you decide not to testify? Are you sure your lawyer's right? a little simple question like, does your client intend to testify? Will he take the stand? The lawyer says yes or no. The client is there. You know, has that been discussed with the client? Yes. End of story. That alerts the client if there's any problem. And then this kind of situation doesn't arise. I'm well aware of what our case law is, and I agree that we don't want to get into that relationship. But that kind of simple question really doesn't open the door to all their discussion.
Here, where there had been so much in terms of direct communication, I think to say that there was any misunderstanding.
I understand, and that wasn't my question. My question was, is it the practice in Southern District by the judges to ask such a question when the defense case is closing? That was my only question.
Yes, Your Honor, of counsel, but I can't say that that happened here. Mr. Borowski says that it happened between him and the judge. I just didn't witness it.
But not in the way Judge Williams is talking about. I mean, she's actually asking you a fairly simple question.
Thing.
You know, is there a moment toward the end of the defense case where the judge just gets it out on the record with the prosecutor there, defense counsel, defendant, judge, court reporter? You know,
it happened in this case. Not in that manner, Your Honors. Closing argument. My co-counsel, I thought, made an excellent closing argument. And I just asked the courts Pardon?
Effective, too.
Well, the rebuttal was pretty good, too, but we had a lot of evidence. But I think the easy, or it occurred to me, an easy way to analyze this, how would the closing argument have been any different at all if the defendant had testified? It would have been exactly the same argument. Through his counsel testifying, somewhat in argument, but, you know, he was a bulldog. He pushed, and he pushed the defense his client chose, and through these 23 witnesses. It was a bad defense. I mean, Mr. Stark actually is quite observant when he said his witnesses were horrible witnesses for him. They were more like witnesses for the government. Well, that was true. It was a bad defense, and we proved that it was a bad defense. Mr. Stark is just through able counsel trying to negotiate his way out again and get a second chance. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Mr. Eberhardt will give you a full minute, if not a bit more, to respond.
I'll be brief. I think you guys touched upon this at the end. According to Mr. Borowski, there's no evidence in the record of this discussion. Mr. Borowski testified that the judge pulled him aside, and just him, and not Mr. Stark, and asked him during the government's case.
Was he wearing those
earmuffs?
No,
this was apparently, I don't know when this happened. It wasn't
Well, if he was wearing them during the trial, we assume he was wearing them then.
I don't know. I don't know any. I assume that if it
on
happened.
On the record, one way or the other.
Right, but it's not on the record that there were no other sidebars. Even when they went off the record to hold these ex parte discussions, they put that on the record. I'm going to have a conversation outside the presence of the government now. There's no indication, and that's not when Mr. Borowski said this happened. So this happened some other time. There's no indication on the record when it happened. And what he did, the judge did, is asked his lawyer. The Ortega case is directly on point here. The inquiry should be of the defendant directly because he's the one that has the right to either testify or waive that right. And in Ortega, this court held that it was error, albeit harmless error, but error for the court to direct that inquiry of the lawyer.
But that was a case where the court was alerted to a problem.
Right, and I understand we're
That's the difference, and certainly that makes sense. When the court is alerted to a problem, it should be directly to the defendant.
And we've talked about that. I think it was alerted of a problem that should have sufficed for him to have asked Mr. Stark that. Briefly, the last point on the closing argument, Mr. Quinley said that the argument would have been the same if he testified. I submit that that's not the case. Mr. Stark's own lawyer said Mr. Stark did not say that his son didn't steal these tractors and could not say it. The implication there was that he didn't say it and he was unable to rebut the allegations. And I don't think that would have happened if Mr. Stark had testified.
Okay, well, thank you very much. You were also appointed, I understand. We thank you very much and your firm for accepting this appointment, for helping your client, the court. Thank you also to the government. We'll take the case under advisement. The court will be adjourned until this time tomorrow morning.